You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Catherine Eben didn't set out to discover how America got into the business of torture, but in the course of a 10-month investigation, the Vanity Fair reporter learned about two psychologists who were responsible for the widespread proliferation of coercive interrogation tactics, tactics that are being used in the United States War on Terror in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the CIA's black sites. She shares her findings in the article Rorschach and Awe, which is published exclusively on VanityFair.com. And I am pleased to welcome Catherine to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
What had you initially set out to learn?
Well, about 10 months ago, a group of psychologists who were members of the American Psychological Association came to me and were very upset about a decision of a task force that determined that psychologists could help the military in detainee interrogations. This made psychologists stand alone when the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association basically pulled their members and banned them from the interrogation booth.
And the APA had ruled on two matters. One was on a psychologist's involvement with military interrogations, and the other on human rights law standards?
Well, basically what the task force said is, it's okay if there's a conflict between international law and orders that you receive from your chain of command, you can follow the orders, which basically meant that they were choosing the lower standard for adherence to civil rights in the view of a number of the psychologists who were outraged about the decision.
And the psychologists, one of them anyway, Dr. Arrigo, described the makeup of the task force as being kind of almost, well, leaning toward the military.
She felt, as a number of other psychologists did, that this task force was stacked with members who had ties to the military. A number of them were directly in charge of overseeing psychologists, who would be in a position to be assisting in interrogations. She felt that the whole thing was rigged so that basically there was a preordained conclusion. We were going to let psychologists participate.
And why would the APA do that, do you think?
Well, that was the question. That was where I started 10 months ago, and it wasn't quite clear. Some people were saying to me, well, this is for development of the field. This is for job opportunities. This is for anything that will enlarge their sphere of responsibility and influence.
Did you go to the military to find out what was going on?
Well, I went to a number of people in the military. I went to the military officially. I went to a number of psychologists. And the more I reported, the more it didn't quite make sense. On the one hand, what they were saying did appear to be true, that psychologists were deeply involved in interrogations, but the people on the task force in the military with members of the task force, a number of them had actually opposed the most coercive measures. And so that made me wonder, well, what is really going on?
Well, what reasons did Army leaders give at first to explain why psychologists would be part of interrogations?
Well, their line from the very beginning is that psychologists' presence in the interrogation booth makes interrogations safer, legal, and more effective. And that if you have psychologists there who can act as a break on the worst tendencies of an interrogator, that means that the detainee would be more likely not to be harmed.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, on the one hand, it does, but on the other hand, it seemed you actually needed psychologists to oversee more coercive interrogations. In other words, they needed to make the more dangerous interrogations safer. And the question is, what was really going on? What were psychologists being used for? Where had these interrogation methods come from?
How did you come across the psychologists that you write about, James Elmer Mitchell and Bruce Jessen?
Well, the whole time I was reporting, I kept on hearing about another team of psychologists. It was not just the military psychologists, but there was another group of psychologists. And these guys were like a psychic wrecking crew that made what was going on within the military look like a day at the beach. And I won't say how because it comes from confidential sources, but I did get their names. Once I got their names, my reporting changed completely. And now I understood that, in fact, it was this group of psychologists who were promulgating these tactics and who were implicating the military psychologists who were actually really in a different place.
And these are people in private practice?
Well, some of them, I wouldn't say private practice. They have their own company. So they were with the military, and they were with a program called SEER, which is Survival Evasion Resistance Escape. This is a military program that helps train GIs to evade capture and to resist torture. And they were the guys who actually helped to oversee this program and make it safe for the people undergoing training.
So, well, let me back up. So SEER is there to prepare people who might be captured and then be tortured to be able to deal with it.
That's right. It's supposed to help inoculate special forces and other people who are might be most likely to be captured. It helps inoculate them against the stress of capture.
And this is based on the assumption that we might be tortured by some enemy. So how does that, what happened here? It sounds to me like these people did a kind of a back formation and then suggested some of the things that they were teaching us how to resist as ways that we might try to coerce people we had imprisoned.
That's absolutely right. The phrase that's used is reverse engineered, that these were the guys who took these training tactics, which were to be used only as training methods on U.S. soldiers, and they reverse engineered them and applied them to detainees in interrogation settings.
Now, there's a 3-week SEER training program. How do people describe that?
Every branch of the military has SEER training. The curriculum varies a little bit, but the people I spoke to who went through it say it remains among the most terrifying experiences of their lives. Some of them over 3 weeks lose 15 pounds from the stress, from the starvation rations. They are sexually and spiritually, religiously humiliated. Some of them are waterboarded, in which water is poured up their nostrils. Basically, they're reduced to husks. And the idea is that you literally form an inoculation against the stress of this experience so that if you are captured, you can resist it and you can return with honor. That's the idea of the training.
My guest is Catherine Eban, whose article, Rorschach and Awe, is published exclusively on VanityFair.com. We'll find out later why it wasn't in the magazine. And it was published on July 17th, but that means it's still available on the website?
Absolutely, it's there.
How were these psychologists connected to the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah?
Well, there had been a number of rumors and a couple of sort of oblique printed reports about the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, and this was really a seminal interrogation in the War on Terror. He was one of America's first high-value detainees, subsequently described by some as sort of an al-Qaeda travel agent. He was captured in a firefight in Pakistan, taken to a safe house in Thailand.
And then the FBI was in control of the interrogation, wasn't it?
Well, the CIA interrogation team hadn't shown up yet. So the FBI agents who were on site began questioning Zubaydah using typical, what they call, rapport-building techniques, trying to identify with the person, put them at ease, and it was through that method of interrogation that he revealed who the planner of 9/11 had been.
And this is 6 months or so after 9/11?
Yeah. It was in early April 2002.
Now, the FBI has often said that it doesn't believe in using torture, that they believe that this is a more effective way of interrogating prisoners. So why wasn't this acceptable? Why did the CIA wind up taking over the interrogation?
Well, Some would say that it was not acceptable simply as a question of a turf battle, that the CIA wanted control. They arrived on the scene finally, and they said, okay, we're in charge now. Now we're going to start with a whole new set of techniques, and this was basically going to be an effort to scare Zubeda almost to death, to sever his personality, to make him dependent on his interrogators, using methods in which he would lose all control over every comfort and every bodily need.
Now, there's been a lot of concern expressed about whether these kinds of techniques break human rights treaties. Did anyone raise objections at the time?
Well, according to my sources, an all-out war broke out at this safe house between those who were supporting rapport-building tactics and those who supported these more coercive interrogation methods, which included using a coffin and threatening to bury Zubeda alive.
Wow. You say there's a myth associated with this incident about the success of SEER tactics. What's the myth?
The myth is that the tactics worked. The myth is that it was those tactics that got Zubeda to talk, and only those tactics.
They just ignored what the FBI had achieved?
Well, that is what a number of sources have told me. You know, the question is, I mean, a lot of people have asked questions about morally, ethically, what does it do to the good name of the United States? What does it do to us to use these tactics? But I wanted to look at another question, which is, did these tactics even work? Were they necessary?
Does the employment of psychologists kind of suggest that they're scientific?
Sure it does. In some ways, this is about the mythic power of the PhD. You know, these psychologists presented to the CIA these SEER tactics as a science, and basically loaned to these tactics, as one source told me, a patina of pseudoscience.
And there are scientists who object. The Physicians for Human Rights 2005 report, breaking them down, said that these coercive tactics don't work.
That has been the conclusion of a number of people in the intelligence community. I think possibly more important even than that report is the Educing Information Report, which came out last year and produced by a number of people who are experts in human intelligence, who are saying there's no evidence these tactics work.
My guest is Catherine Eban, whose article Rorschach and Awe was published VanityFair.com on July 17th. It's available to anyone who goes there. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Catherine Eban. Her article, Rorschach and Awe, was published exclusively on VanityFair.com, and there is a link to the article on our show page at WNYC.org. Catherine, the obvious question that came to mind to me was, why isn't this in the magazine proper? This is the kind of big story we have associated with Vanity Fair in the past.
Well, as you all know, Vanity Fair is a monthly, so it takes a number of months to get something into a magazine, and there really were a number of events that were brewing around this topic that made us feel we needed to get this out as quickly as possible, not least of which is a Senate investigation into the use of these SEER tactics.
Have they been talking to Drs. Mitchell and Jessen?
I don't know if they've actually talked to them, but as Salon had reported last month, they issued a preservation order to the Defense Department asking them to preserve any documents related to Mitchell and Jessen.
Did Mitchell and Jessen have any intelligence experience?
According to my sources, none.
So this is another example of privatization?
You certainly can look at it that way, but a number of people have said to me they had no evidence that these tactics work. They had never conducted an interrogation with foreign nationals. These were purely support psychologists working in aid of a training program.
And as you've said, there are many people in the military and elsewhere who don't believe in this sort of thing. Military officials like Colonel Britton Mallow used different tactics, not SEER, when they started interrogations at Guantanamo Bay. What was Colonel Mallow's background?
Well, he had a degree in Middle East studies. He'd had extensive experience as a military policeman, and his view is he wanted to preserve the possibility of bringing these people to trial. And if you want to do that, then you need to use interrogation tactics that are admissible in a court of law. And basically that points you towards rapport-building tactics.
What were some of the reports he started to receive in the summer of 2002?
It was the spread of these SEER tactics. It was strobe lights, extreme temperatures in the interrogation booths, stress positions, all those kinds of tactics that have come to be associated with SEER.
And he raised his concerns with his superiors. What happened?
This fight over tactics went all the way up to the top of the Pentagon.
And I guess that means Donald Rumsfeld.
That's correct. And Donald Rumsfeld famously issued a memo in which he approved of most of the tactics. And he said about the stress positions, why standing only 4 hours? I stand 8 to 10 hours a day. And that was in his own handwriting at the bottom of the memo.
He didn't mention that he stood, that we would have to stand on a stool with his hands tied above his head.
Yeah, I don't think he stands like that.
Well, and then there was Major General Michael Dunleavy. He took over as commander of the Joint Task Force Guantanamo. And he was one of the people who instituted the SEER tactics?
That is correct. He actually formed a team of psychologists that were called a BISCT team, Behavioral Science Consultation Team. He set up a workshop for psychologists at Fort Bragg, which was basically a workshop in SEER training.
You also came upon a 5-page memo about the new interrogation procedures at Guantanamo Bay. How did you gain access to that document?
Well, that document, a number of people would like a copy of that document. It's a SEER SOP, or Standard Operating Procedure, memo, which was drafted by the Joint Task Force GITMO right after Rumsfeld approved of the overall tactics. And it was basically a document saying, here's how we're going to apply the SEER interrogation tactics. It talked about degradation, manhandling, a tactic called walling, where you throw a detainee against a wall, but it was all carefully couched in which the tactics would be calibrated so as not to prove lethal.
And that was the determining factor, that they not be lethal. But the president has said we don't practice torture at all.
Well,
so is this also a matter of determining what torture really is?
There has been a lot of debate in this country about the definition of torture, but these are, the question of torture is governed by international human rights treaties, most famously the Geneva Conventions, and also by American law. So a number of people would say that these tactics are torture, they are outrages upon human dignity, which are violations of Geneva. They inflict pain and suffering. Now, of course, the Bush administration has defined it quite differently. There was a famous memo written in August 2002, which defines torture as anything inflicting permanent bodily harm akin to death or organ failure.
The president also said that our intelligence experts are highly trained. Did you find that to be true?
One of the things that I was told is that a number of the interrogators received on-site or on-detainee training, as it were, in which the interrogations were conducted as live demonstrations where interrogators in training basically looked on or participated.
Now, has the Bush administration created a firewall here, or did senior officials sign off on that 5-page document?
Well, according to information that I have, they apparently did sign off on it, but it's not exactly clear. how far the sign-off went, or whether this SOP ever became formally adopted policy.
My guest is Catherine Eban. Her article, Rorschach and Awe, is available through our website at WNYC.org or through VanityFair.com about torture procedures that are rather controversial, but that involve psychologists. And now we come to Abu Ghraib. We all remember those horrifying pictures from Abu Ghraib. Were they, did they illustrate SEER techniques?
Well, it was sort of like this ghoulish game of telephone where, you know, the further you get from the original source, the more twisted and deformed the use of the tactics became. But what you see at Abu Ghraib is a very gross version of the SEER tactics used in the CIA interrogation. So you have the sexual and religious degradation, the extreme temperatures, these humiliating human pyramids, dog tricks, walking detainees around on leashes. And in fact, one of the military policemen, Charles Grainer, who was subsequently prosecuted for his activities softening up detainees, was given some sort of award for his activities. Now, that's way downhill from an award that supposedly Mitchell and Jessen earned from the CIA for their activities.
Of course, Grainer later went to jail. I think he's in prison now, isn't he? And Mitchell and Jessen are still in business. Did you ever speak to them?
Unfortunately, they declined to speak with me. They issued Vanity Fair a statement in which they said that they were proud of their service to their country, and that they were dismayed by the abuses at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and had nothing to do with those events.
Now, Congress has gotten into the act, but it's interesting that the split hasn't been totally along party lines. John McCain, who was subjected to torture himself in Vietnam, was one of the people in Congress who were most opposed to this sort of thing. What's been happening? Have things changed with the changing of the guard in Congress, with the Democrats now in power?
Well, one of the things that I report on is that the Senate Armed Services Committee under Senator Carl Levin is planning on holding hearings into the use of these activities and interrogation tactics. But what they're saying is they are going to look at holding officials accountable for the promulgation of these tactics.
Now, there's been a big to-do about the firing of federal prosecutors. A lot more outrage expressed there than at this sort of thing. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's an enormous myth, to use that word again, that these tactics really work. That if you have a detainee with ticking time bomb information about the destruction of a U.S. city, for example, that using these tactics is the only way and the best way to get them to talk. So you have even Supreme Court Justice Scalia saying to a gathering that he approves effectively of the Jack Bauer tactics, which is what everybody sees on the television show 24. I've had sources say to me, you know, if somebody has ticking time bomb information, I'm going to have a cup of tea with him. And it's exactly that rapport building that is going to be most effective. Of course, it's very hard to have a scientific study in which you'd have to effectively experiment on human subjects. We don't do that, or at least we certainly say we don't do that. So how do you get a convincing evidence of what works? And that is something that the intelligence community is grappling with right now.
Now, the ticking bomb scenario is often invoked in these kinds of discussions. Has there ever been a case where there was a ticking bomb and where SEER-type techniques got the person to admit that the bomb was hidden somewhere and would go off in an hour?
Well, I think that the CIA would say that their interrogation of the high-value detainees is that scenario, that they feared very...
Well, we haven't been able to find any of the top al-Qaeda leaders, for example. Wouldn't all of these interrogation techniques have led us to Osama bin Laden, for example?
One might imagine, though the CIA has definitely made the argument that these tactics have been effective in disrupting plots.
And Vice President Cheney told a talk show host that that waterboarding was, I can't remember what word he used, but he felt that there should be no argument over whether something like that should be employed under certain circumstances. Is he where the buck stops in this story?
I think that remains to be seen. I do have this anecdote in the article in which after a number of these myths began to be probed, a high-level staffer in his office called up one of the nation's top SEER researchers to say, what is the impact of stress on individuals, and does it get them to talk, extreme stress? You know, this is a situation in which there was a market for a solution to the human intelligence problem. Everybody wanted to have the solution to getting detainees to talk. And so this may have been a case in which the CIA was ready to listen to somebody with a PhD saying that they knew the solution. But I don't think we have any evidence, in fact, that it did work.
Do you have any sense of whether the investigation by Carl Levin or your article has affected Mitchell and Jessen's private practice?
That I don't know. I cannot say for sure. But as we report in the article, their business had been booming. They have a 120-person firm in Spokane, Washington. They've clearly been doing very well, making a lot of money, prospering. So, of course, some people feel, well, they're making a profit on the backs of detainees.
Do you think that these techniques have been cut back since so much attention has been paid to them?
Well, the administration has said that the CIA program was suspended until very recently, when they just issued last week, President Bush issued an executive order clarifying the guidelines under which the CIA interrogations are going to take place. And this executive order says, basically, we're going to observe the Geneva Conventions, but it does not specify which tactics they're going to use. And so human rights folks have been very critical of this executive order, saying it's basically paying lip service to the Geneva Conventions, but is going to permit torture to continue.
Were you surprised by the extent of what you found while you were investigating the story?
Extremely. Surprised, really, on two counts. On the one hand, you know, a number of people said to me, well, you'll never be able to get this article out. You're going to hit a wall because much of this information is classified. So perhaps it is a testament to how angry people in the intelligence community were about the use of these tactics that they were willing to talk to me. I mean, some people feel that these two guys did more harm to national security than they would ever realize. So it was surprising in that regard, but it was also surprising that psychologists would find themselves sort of once again at the forefront of dubious CIA tactics, which is exactly a repeat to some extent of the MKUltra experience of the 1950s, in which mental health professionals were involved in very questionable activities trying to do mind control experiments.
Including giving people LSD without telling them.
Absolutely. So there was tremendous experimentation on human subjects, which is, you know, the scenario was somewhat different, but as Physicians for Human Rights said to me, it's basically the same scenario. You have people who are loaning their scientific credentials to these projects.
And do you think that the APA condones it simply because this is what psychologists do? They got to make a living?
Well, it's a question as to what exactly the APA condones. I think that they would say, though I didn't ask them specifically, that they would not condone the activities of Mitchell and Jessen, who, by the way, are not APA members. What they condone is the continued involvement of psychologists in military interrogations.
What reactions have you received so far to the story?
Well, I've received really a wide range of very positive reactions because I think people feel this is a story that needed to be told. I have not really encountered a lot of criticism, but I haven't heard from any of the psychologists in Spokane who I wrote about, so I don't know how they feel about the article.
And nobody has said that you're harming national security by revealing this information?
I have not encountered that criticism yet.
Are you going to continue on the story?
Yes, very much so. I want to continue reporting in this area. I've always been, I'm very interested in this sort of nexus of medical and public health problems and homeland security. I think it's sort of a rich territory to explore.
Catherine Eban's article, Rorschach and Awe, was published exclusively in VanityFair.com, but you can also find it through a link on our website at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.